Charlie Foxtrot. I'm Boom.
I'm Cetra.
And we are going to talk about Air Part 3.
Yes.
And it is one hell of a Charlie Foxtrot, isn't it?
It is. It's interesting to me that it's actually still a Part 3. Like, I understand it's solving the same problem.
Right.
But it feels very much like its own episode.
Well, it's because it's on that planet.
Yeah, it is the most Stargate-y of the three episodes so far.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's the least Stargate-y because there's no alien cultures to interact with.
Oh, is Stargate about alien cultures? I thought it was about...
why else would Daniel be there?
well, I was pretty sure Stargate was about Jack O'Neill running through Stargates and messing shit up and or almost dying.
Yeah, with cultures.
Oh, with cultures. Yes. I missed that part.
It's well, just no. Him saying the wrong thing and Daniel, like, coming behind him, like, sweeping up, like, no, what we meant was.
Yeah. No culture this time, though we do find out that they do bring some aliens back from this planet later.
Yeah, they do. They do, but again, not really culture because it's a parasite. And they have to kill it, essentially, right?
You don't know. You don't know what those tiny, tiny, micro-sized organisms are doing. They could be a diverse and complex culture, but because Daniel is not here, we will never know.
I was going to say, that's the Star Trek consideration. No! I can't even remember the episode now. I just watched it, though. Like, the title of it. But they're like, no! That ore that you're mining is actually aliens, and that's why it keeps killing you.
Oh, wow.
And they're like, how could it be sentient? It's made of silicon or whatever. And they have a big debate about it. Lots of people die. And then they just leave the planet alone. Star Trek.
Yep. Star Trek. Concern for sapience. Always.
Before we start this, though, I want to say that I watched the extended version now. There's a lot of extra scenes that may inform some of the things that we talked about earlier, so I kind of want to bring them up right now.
Okay.
One of the extra scenes is we actually do see Rush talk to Colonel O'Neill in the extended version.
And
O'Neill is... We never have evidence saying that Rush will be the leader or not, but he is pissed at Rush for not getting them to a different planet. Yeah, because none of them are trained for it, which is a little interesting because obviously in this episode, Young is like, none of us are trained for it, and O'Neill's like, not taking that shit. I don't care.
Well, in a lot of ways, that's very Jack O'Neill, though, right? Like, to Rush, he's like, you bastard, here's all the actual problems with what you did.
Right.
Young doesn't need to hear that. Young knows all of that.
Right.
Young needs to be told, it's going to work.
Right.
I believe in you. Make it happen.
I'm not going to lie, the O'Neill-Rush conversation took me a little bit off of the Rush Apologist Society.
Oh, is Rush a jerk?
Well, a little bit, but I guess, I don't know, I'm slightly on his side because, yes, this was the only chance for something that's amazing, and if the Lucian Alliance is after it, Earth probably should be the first people to get there, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, he also made a lot of people suffer when he could have gated to an uninhabited planet. But saying that, I'm going to go up right back onto the Rush Apologist Society train. They would have to go through a lot of gate addresses to figure out which is the best planet to possibly accidentally explode.
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at... Well, possibly accidentally explode, thereby killing everyone you just sent through the gate to evacuate also.
Right.
And Rush says... In this very episode we're about to watch, like, it would take way more than a few hours or even a few days to find out if a planet is truly viable.
Right.
Like, the best option is not just, well, let's dump these people on a planet.
Well, I mean, but they would have had, because they're still in the Milky Way when this was happening, when the initial attacks were happening.
Were they?
They would have had a database, right?
Okay.
But I think it would have taken minutes they didn't have.
Like, it's true.
Because remember, that explosion pretty much happened right after the gate closed.
Why not? Here's my thing. Why not freaking dial Atlantis? Tell them, okay, we have this many people evacuating. Close the iris immediately. Because that thing has taken explosions before. Doesn't Atlantis have that thing that seals the gate?
Yeah, but wouldn't that kill people?
Well, if they were still coming through the gate, yes.
Right.
But, I mean, as we find out in this episode, the gates also have safety mechanisms to prevent people
Right.
getting.
So if the explosion was already went through the gate.
Oh, I guess that's true. But
Yeah.
Atlantis is strong. It probably
I
wouldn't blow up.
mean, they got some ZPMs for it.
Hell,
They've got it charged up a
gate.
little
Don't
bit.
gate directly to Atlantis, gate to one of the, like, gates in a random uninhabited forest on the same planet as Atlantis.
No, because that power would still probably destroy a huge portion of. I don't know. It's hard
Okay.
to say. It's hard to say. We're both Rush apologists. I think
Yeah.
O'Neill is really angry and
And
understandably
with good
pissed.
reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think Rush is only by a very, very small margin, like 0.0001% more right than everyone else.
That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Okay. Next, there's also a scene where Rush tries to explain the importance of the ship to Eli, while Eli like secretly records him. This is
Oh.
much later. It's like after Armstrong dies, and Eli goes from being like, "Yes, Rush, I'm on your side because you talked me out of my existential crisis," to he doesn't trust Rush at all, and he suggests that Rush wanted to get on the ship because he wanted to become all powerful.
See, and I, okay, so my original access to the show, I must have had the extended stuff because I remember that scene. And I
Right.
felt like stuff was missing from the Hulu version, and that must be it.
So I thought that was interesting. I'm like, Eli is like a sinusoidal wave when it comes to Rush because in the episode we're about to talk about, he's with Rush and then against Rush and then with Rush and then against Rush.
Yeah,
It's
I mean,
insane.
Eli really wants a parent figure, a guiding figure.
Right.
We have no evidence that he's ever had a father figure in his life.
Right.
And I think, you know, being thrown in as he was with Rush, being working on the same problem together,
Right.
that made sense for him to, like, oh yeah, like, I'm gonna get along with this guy. I understand science. We're both smart. But Rush is such an asshole.
I think Rush is under stress. I don't think he is. I don't know. I see a lot more friendliness in him than I remembered watching this series the first time.
I don't know. There's evidence, like in last episode where he was talking to Chloe, and sometimes this episode, though less because of how much stress he's under,
Right.
when he has a little bit of energy, he
Right.
can pretend to be genuine and friendly.
Right.
He's just not great at it.
Well, so I guess the reason why I am a RAS in this situation is because at the very end, and I do want to talk about this later, when he has Eli stick his arm through the Stargate to make sure that the ship doesn't leave,
Yeah.
when he orders Eli to do that, his face is so tortured. Like, he doesn't know if it's gonna work. He might be sentencing Eli to his death, and he has to make a really hard decision because he's the only one that can make that decision. Because Young is just
Yeah.
sitting there like, I have no idea.
And I have a lot of thoughts about that scene in
Right.
particular, actually, and what it says about Rush, what it because what happens, and we can maybe edit this and move it to the end, I don't know. Rush doesn't tell Young what he's about to tell Eli to do. Because
Right.
if he said to Young, tell him to put his arm in the gate, he would have to have the fight with Young right there.
Right, that's true.
And he knows he couldn't win it fast enough.
Right.
So he just asks for the radio, takes the radio, and tells Eli to do it.
Right.
Because he knows that he has to make that decision and he doesn't want to bother explaining himself to anybody.
Right, which is pretty typical for him.
Which is very typical Rush. And then when Eli gets through and everything's fine, he says, "Good job, Eli."
Right.
In like the most earnest moment of emotion and gratitude we've seen
And
from
he
him so
gives him
far.
water, and I want to know whose rations those were.
Yeah, it wasn't his and it wasn't Riley's.
Riley.
But at the same time, I'm like, "Oh, you're, yeah. Good job, Eli. What are you encouraging him to do in the future? In future, you're encouraging him to listen to you and do what you say without question, even if it sounds insane. That's what he has to do to get a good job, Eli, out of you."
Well, okay, let's talk about that a little bit later. But I like that interpretation because I have a couple more extended scenes to go through.
Oh,
and
sweet.
Then,
yay.
Another one is, I really am glad they took this one out. Lieutenant James, as Young is going to find Chloe to, like, comfort her.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's in this episode, isn't it? So maybe we should wait until we get to that part. But when Young goes to comfort Chloe,
Do you mean Young or do you mean Scott?
James. I mean James. No, it's Young. So Young goes to talk to Chloe about, like, her dad dying.
Okay.
And it basically uses all the same words that Rush uses.
Yeah. But in Young version, so it's more understandable to her.
I thought it was less effective on her. I was actually really surprised. Okay. Yeah. Because she didn't talk back to Rush, but she sure as hell talked back to Young. But anyways, you find out that James is really angry that she's there at all because they put her on the Stargate program because it was supposed to be safer than Iraq. Like, she was supposed to be shipped out to Iraq. And then they're like, hey, you can join Stargate. And guess what? You probably won't die in a desert. And
yeah. And in episode 4, as we see, Eli starts recording people's kind of, you know, statements for posterity with the Kinos.
Right.
And James's is just, I don't want to die here.
Right. And I think that's good. I like that one because that fits. It gives her a moment of reprieve from that tough guy attitude she's had to have. But in this particular scene, because she's mad at, so what happens is Young is like, where's Chloe? And she's like, she's somewhere, but why do you want to know? He's like, I want to go check on her. And she's like, how about you check on me? And Young is like, what? And she gets really upset with him because she's like, I'm suffering, I'm hurting, and all you care about are the civilians. So, I mean, I liked the part that where the military is like, hey, stop mollycoddling the civilians. But at the same time, is like, I want James to have that exterior. Like, yes, she can be broken on the inside, as we'll see later on episodes. But to have that established early on almost undermines that mask that she is so good at putting up.
Yeah, and we have so few female characters. I appreciate that they didn't decide to do that to
weaken another one. Yeah,
I mean, she's already, and I hate that the society does this, but she's already, you know, been having sex with people.
She's already been slut shamed in the eyes of the viewers.
Yeah, so she's already been super slut shamed and kind of, you know, and then treated by the guy she was having sex with as though he didn't know her.
Right.
Like,
God so damn she's it, Matt.
Yeah. She's already, well, and as we'll find out in this episode, this is really a Matt episode.
Yeah.
She's already got some of that stuff weakening her character going on. I'd rather they just leave her.
Right.
And in all honesty, let that build up a little bit more before you're going to your commanding officer like, wah.
Right. I felt out of character for her. So I'm really glad that they took that out. And then all the extra scenes we don't have to go into after that because they're in this episode. I had forgotten that the last one was in this episode as well.
Oh, okay. So it was a huge extended, like, movie length air.
Yeah, it's like how it was intended to be, and I loved it. And the commentary with David Blue, Brian Smith, and Elise Levesque is really, really good.
Oh, awesome.
Like, I have a ton of respect for them. Like, I had a lot of respect for them in the beginning, but just listening to them talk about how they thought about their characters and their craft, it was really interesting to know how seriously they took it.
Yeah, I love actor shop talk.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I wish there was more writers doing commentaries because I'm more interested to know what the writer's intent was rather than actors. But
I still think the writers are, in some situations, and I don't know these writers specifically, but I've heard writer commentaries, and sometimes they're not as eloquent in talking about it.
Right, because it's not their job to speak.
Yeah, as an actor has a much narrower scope to their work also.
Right.
Like, they can focus on their character. It's much easier to talk about their character than for a writer to go, well, we needed Young to do this and this to get here in his character. We needed Rush to do this and this.
I mean, as a writer myself, I don't really see it that way. But maybe I'm just the only good writer's commentary person. Who knows?
Oh, clearly. Absolutely.
So anyways, let's start with the episode. Only 15 minutes into the podcast.
Woo!
There's a Kino in the air. It looks really snowy, but nope, it's not snow. It's a motherfucking hot desert.
Yup. We pick up exactly where we left off at the end with people passing through.
Right.
Into just nowheresville.
Or White Sands, New Mexico.
Yeah, this is, it is, I think, one of the most bleak locations for a Stargate I've ever seen.
The commentary said that it was as hot as 117 degrees while they were out there.
And so you've got civilians and scientists who've been given desert camo.
Mm-hmm.
But remember that all our military people, or most of them, fled Icarus in their dress BDUs.
Right.
Which is what Scott still gets to wear.
Unless unless he uses a communication stone and then he's in somebody's fatigues.
Well, yeah. All right. It must be just delightful to go back to Earth and be like, oh my God, I'm clean. It's not even my body, but I'm clean.
You're just like shuffling around and like, there's no sweat on my arms.
Yeah.
So I like when they're walking through the gate because Eli is really amazed. Rush looks fucking pleased with himself. And then the other ones are just, they're like, ugh.
Yeah.
No interest.
Yeah, Rush looks very like, I like that the fatigues are ill-fitting on the civilians. Like,
right.
Rush and the female scientist, I think it's Palmer is her name.
Palmer, yeah.
Both look like they're kind of swimming in these two big things, and then Eli's doesn't quite button in the front. He's a bigger dude. Like, but you get a lot of shots early on of, you know, the scientists clearly working together and trying to solve the problem, and Greer and Scott are immediately, like, looking at the planet, trying to figure out what they're going to do, how they're going to communicate.
Right.
All that kind of stuff, which is, it's a good evidence of the difference in their mentalities, which is going to be looked at through the whole episode.
I wrote, they have 12 hours with 3 scientists and 3 military. I can't see this going wrong. Nope, nope, not at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess we didn't really talk last episode, but, like, the idea that the ship dialed this planet for them.
Right.
Is very new and very kind of TARDIS-y. Like, true. We've never before had, even Atlantis, which is a semi-sentient city,
right.
Doesn't, like, dial the gate and go, okay, Shepard, I need you to go here.
Right. Well, I think, but it does follow a little bit along the Atlantis lines, just because Atlantis does things to protect them.
Mm.
At least in the beginning. It's not as evident. I think it's because they fuck around with the technology a little bit too much.
Yeah.
It's interesting that this is older technology and is more dictatorial with its occupants, I would say. But it's maybe because they have no idea how to control it. And even if they did, the ship's autopilot is always going to have a better idea of what's going on than they are.
Yeah. I mean, because clearly the ship has somewhere a database that it understands,
right,
with information from all the seed ships.
Right.
And they can't read the database at this time.
Nope.
So they're really just stuck. And Rush is really the only one with that kind of faith that's like, oh, no, the ship will, it's destiny. Destiny will tell us what to do.
Would you say that he's got faith of the heart?
Something like that. He believes in the heart of the cards or whatever it is.
I don't know why I keep bringing Star Trek up in a Stargate podcast.
Because this is a little bit Star Trek-y. Maybe we're both a little bit Star Trek-y.
Well, I'm very Trekky. As anybody who follows my other work will know, I talk about is Star Trek. This is a little less Trekky, though, like, because it's not TNG like the other Stargates are, where they're, like, meeting other cultures and doing, like, basically, like, episode bottle. Sorry, bottle episodes is what I mean. This one, they're not really meeting a whole lot of inhabitants until much later with the Nakai.
Which even then, I don't know if you can ever say they meet them per se.
No, no, like, it's a total othering situation.
Yeah, it's immediate interaction, misunderstanding, and then violence.
There's zero comprehension and therefore enemizing. I just made a word up, but I like it. Enemizing. It sounds like I'm giving someone an enema.
But no, you're right. Just they're so different that they're immediately defined as other and to be feared. And
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But we're not there yet. Right now, all we have to interact with is a desert.
Well, we've talked. They're gonna go and start looking out and finding if they can find any limestone or a lake bed. Paul, I really like Palmer. I'm sad that she's basically dead at the end of this episode because her geological knowledge is probably one of the one things they shouldn't lose at all.
I mean, that's the really hard thing about the science team in general is that they have such a weird scattering of specialties.
Right.
And yeah, you're probably right. Losing the geology this early on, probably messes with them a lot. She would be really useful in a lot of other situations.
Yeah. She could look at a plane, like she can look at the area around them and tell them if it's, a flood plain. Like remember when they're trying to move to a planet and survive? She would inherently know a lot of things that would be helpful for survival, also in finding things that they would need for the ship. So that sucks.
Spoilers, I guess,
Well, not
'cause
really, because it's in this episode that she goes away with Lieutenant Curtis, or I don't know if he's a lieutenant or not. But anyways, so back on the ship, Chloe, Young talks to her.
Oh, this is the scene you're talking about.
Yeah, I said
Okay.
I don't I said he doesn't do a whole lot better job than Rush does.
Sorry, I was trying to remember something in the previous episodes where Young had talked to Chloe at all, and I got
No,
very
I
confused.
accidentally skipped ahead
Got
by
it.
one scene.
So yeah, everybody's very concerned for Chloe, which is nice for telling the audience that she's a main character, but I don't know how necessary it is for the story as a whole.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is what turns me off of Chloe for a while, which is sad because I never ever want to hate a female character, but and I don't hate her. It's just that like I kind of there's so much other pain and suffering on that ship I want to start exploring that isn't just constantly my dad's debt. Which is unfair because it's only really for one episode.
It's well, yeah, and I think
But I want to see the
I
other people.
yeah, the final conversation that Scott has with Chloe in this episode, actually, I have a lot to say about, and I think that is
That was enough.
yeah, that's enough. That's what I actually liked, and
No,
I
I
think that's
agree.
what she needed to hear, so.
I agree. But Chloe wants to tell her mom, she says, and then Young is like, okay, communication stones. Isn't that cool? And then Telford is fucking meditating.
Yeah,
I don't know why,
Telford.
I just like you're a tool.
And this is the first place that we see people talking to Telford about, like, he's been on shift watching the stones, trying to get his consciousness back to Destiny for a long time now.
So suspicious.
So very suspicious. Yeah, like, why? Why is he so devoted?
Even before I knew about the Lucian Alliance stuff. Oh, which by the way, that's the conversation with Eli is that the extended scene thing, Rush also explains to him what the Lucian Alliance is, which they don't tell you in the original aired episode.
That is true.
So like a Lucian Alliance is like almost something forgettable until, 12 episodes later. But even not knowing about the Lucian Alliance because that extended scene wasn't there, I was like, Telford is being so fucking suspicious right now.
Yeah, and I guess, if that was going on in the SGC, if people were noticing, he was probably just going, it was supposed to be my command. I want to know what's going on.
All
We're going to
right.
get there someday. I need to be appraised of their situation.
Right.
But still shifty as crap.
Yeah.
Young then finally has this talk with O'Neill, which we touched on earlier.
Yeah.
O'Neill basically tells him, suck it up. You guys are where you are. You can make it happen. We all did before.
Right.
To which I'm like, yeah, but not everybody is you and Jackson and living in magical Christmas land.
Right. So, what I want to know about the communication stones is how do they know the people are in the bodies that say they're in there? Like, Young just says, I'm Young.
I think at some point later, I mean, there's multiple things, right? I mean, one, I assume that their
Oh.
bearing and their accent and stuff changes. So if you know someone well, you could tell it's them.
Right.
But
So do you think
also,
that poor the original guy that Rush took over, like, the really American-looking guy just started talking in a Scottish brogue?
I assume so.
Okay. Interesting.
So for Rush, you just identify him by accent. Answered. Question answered. No, all of the command people in the SGC have codes and stuff, I assume.
Oh, okay.
So they skipped Young going, you know, okay, yeah, my authorization code is this. Right. My designation is that.
Right.
You
know. Okay. Alrighty.
I agree that it does get shorthanded a lot, and it makes the SGC's security seem laughable.
It's always laughable.
But, yeah, exactly.
I mean, I could actually go to Cheyenne Mountain and take a picture of me in front of where they have that external shot for Stargate all the time. Okay, obviously I can't get into Cheyenne Mountain, but I can at least get as far as that.
Yeah.
And someday I will.
We do live relatively close to that actual place.
Right. Well, there's a very brief scene that Telford is in Young's... No, wait, that hasn't happened yet, does it? Okay. No, the next scene is O'Neill talking to Chloe, right?
Yes, O'Neill...
And O'Neill is the only one who says something right.
Yeah, O'Neill is very respectful and very kind. He's Jack O'Neill, right?
Right. Well, he knows that, like, sometimes people just want to reminisce about the person that they love. They don't want to hear over and over again what an honor he did, blah, blah, blah. They don't care because that person's gone. The honor doesn't make them feel better. The memories do. And O'Neill does that.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what O'Neill is good for. What's always weird for me to remember in these scenes with the communication stones is, like, we're seeing the person who's actually there.
Right.
But, like, he's seeing this random, you know, doctor or whatever
it was.
I think
it was, like, Dr. Benta or something.
Yeah, that Chloe took over the body of and saying, right. I'm so sorry about your father. Like, I understand, but even if you've practiced with, you know, knowing that the stones are changing personalities like that. Or,
right.
Like, it seems like that would be very hard to do. Like,
right.
If I was looking at my brother but trying to treat them like my ex-girlfriend, like,
right,
that would be really hard.
No, that would be really hard. You're right. But good job, O'Neill.
But yeah, no, O'Neill just pulls it off, and I like him a lot in this show.
Mm-hmm.
It's his reactions in this show and occasionally in, like, Atlantis where I've seen him that make me want to tolerate him in early SG-1 because, God, I would not like him at all.
Well, what you're seeing is the developed Colonel O'Neill. So, of course you like him now because he actually became a good guy. He wasn't necessarily a bad guy before, but he was, I would say, immature in a lot of instances. And wasn't quite suited for his role, which is what his conversation to Young is about. Like, none of us were prepared to do that.
Well, we're going to Star Trek again. Yeah. I never really liked Captain Kirk.
Oh,
all the way down to Kirk's, you know, old Kirk who should have learned better in generations. I still don't like him. I like old O'Neill.
I was like the only person. Well, because Kirk never grows. Kirk never does. He is always the same sort of swashbuckling bad decision maker. He's always been.
Yeah.
And if you like that, that's awesome. But I prefer a more developed character. I'm going to get shanked for saying that.
That, you know, I'm sorry.
I don't like Kirk. I like Pike.
Well, you do like Pike. And I feel like new Kirk, Captain Fine, has had more character growth in two movies, granted, not the greatest movies ever. They're not perfect.
Right.
But, like...
No, I agree. I think the character development in those two movies is far better than any of the TV show.
But it was a very different time. We can't judge what was.
You definitely should judge on the basis of the context of the time and how television writing was.
It did something impossible for its time, and good job, Star Trek. I like Jack O'Neill better than James Kirk. Next.
But, well, okay, so I don't know if this is an extended scene or not, because they didn't catch it. The actor's commentary didn't catch it. Young kind of tells O'Neill to kind of shut up, because O'Neill's not being very helpful. And he's like, we're going to die, essentially. Can you just let us say goodbye using the communication stones? And that's how that scene ends. Is that how it ends for you as well?
I remember a conversation like that happening, but I'm not sure
if it was
here. I don't have a note.
Okay. Well, for me, I like that ending much better. Or if it was always the ending, then I just like the ending.
It's young again being
pragmatic.
The big picture.
Yeah.
And yeah, very pragmatic is the word. You're exactly right. He still has hope. He definitely is not giving up.
Right.
But yeah.
He is as pragmatic as Rush is. It's just that he has a different priority, I would think, and different understanding of how the world works. Because, you said he hasn't given up hope, right? But he's at the same time being like, we at least have to give people the chance to say goodbye. Just in case.
Yeah, and what that becomes as the show goes on is they have a rotating cycle and people have a chance to get home.
Right.
In spirit at least. It does, I just double checked, and it does end that way in the broadcast version as well.
Okay, good.
And O'Neill just kind of nods and...
Okay.
You know, they start organizing that, so.
Okay, so back to the planet.
Back to the planet and Rush and Eli.
Everyone hates Franklin.
I don't know. Franklin is just such a non-character in this episode. Like, he does nothing.
Well, no, that's not true. He dials the gate. He figures out how to dial the other gates. He gets shot in the arm. He gets a lot of things. Like, Greer yells at him because he's like, you should save your water. And then Franklin's like, well, I'm the scientist, and I'm going to tell you, like, it's better to stay hydrated than to get dehydrated and then drink the water.
Yeah. It's definitely, like, Drill Sergeant Greer time.
Right.
And these civilians are not equipped for it.
I know later on in my notes it says, I think this is why he got put in a cell. Like, he cannot handle civilians. He just can't. Like, kicking Rush, like, yes, Rush was being obnoxious, but you probably shouldn't kick him, dude.
Well, and what we don't see is any conversation between Scott and Greer, but we know that Scott was told specifically to keep an eye on Rush.
Right.
And if Greer read that in Scott's demeanor, and or... just accepted it. Like,
right.
Greer already doesn't like Rush.
Right.
So it's very easy to take, like, oh, well, my commanding officer doesn't trust him to be on his own. He wants him with us. That means, you know, time for some discipline.
Well, we also find out later that part of the reason for the split is because Eli's slowing them down so much that he wants Eli off the team.
Yeah, well, and I think...
So I don't know if it's all necessarily Rush watching. Like, I'm sure a large part of it is. But a lot of, I feel like the way he was giving the reasons was not necessarily the most transparent.
Yeah, I mean, Rush goes, okay, I'll lead this team. Because, of course, as we've said, Rush would always rather be in control of himself.
Right.
And Scott goes, no, you're with me and Greer.
Right.
Which is clearly going, no, you're with people who could overpower you if needed.
Which is so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Scott's not subtle.
In light of recent events, I can see why people are paranoid about it, but...
Yeah, I mean, and knowing what we know about Rush from later, and we're starting to see in this episode, like, he's dealing with the harshness of this, you know, hike across the desert, and the, you know, fast pace and the discipline and all of that much better without bitching about it than a lot of the other scientists are.
I know. Let's talk a little bit about that, right? So, like, they're walking along. This is before they split up, you know. Eli is basically doing the entire plot to Planet of the Apes.
Eli's first, like, random pop culture reference, which gets a reaction of crickets. Like, nothing.
What is... Rush goes, Eli, drink your water. No, he says, Eli, have a drink. And I was like, does he think there's alcohol in that?
Does he think being drunk would make Eli less annoying? Like,
well, I think he just means if he drinks, then he won't talk.
Yeah, he'll shut up for a minute.
But I feel like that's the nicest Rush has ever been to shut somebody up. Like, you can tell that he's been listening to it for, like, hours now.
Well, we start to see very clearly that Rush has, like, a list in his mind of people who are useful in order of priority.
Right.
And Eli is clearly the highest on that list of the people on that the planet with him right now.
Right, right. Well, yeah, because he hates Franklin. Well, I don't think he hates Franklin. He just thinks Franklin's stupid.
Yeah, he doesn't hate Franklin. I think it's in one of the next two episodes we see him just, like, scream at Volker for nothing.
Well, yeah. That's because Rush doesn't deal with stress very well. Not an excuse. Just something to be aware of with him.
Or he deals with stress extremely well, as he's doing on this planet, right?
That's like, true. And but he has a breaking point.
Yeah, he knows how to buckle down and get through.
Right.
Up to a point.
Right. I think that's the same for everybody, though.
Well, clearly his is a lot higher than, say, Eli's or Franklin's.
Yeah. Well, anyways, then Scott wants to split up the team, as we talked about. Eli has a bad feeling about it. That was me trying to do a Han Solo voice.
Yeah. Give or take.
Give or take. And then Scott, like, does his, like, placating thing. Oh, it's because I trust you and blah, blah, blah. And yeah. Eli, like, actually thinks he's in charge of two qualified scientists and a military guy.
Well, which is, you know, that's what... That's, again, it's Scott using, like, straight up, you know, officer school 101.
Right.
Right? Like, you need someone to do something for you. They're giving you flack. You know, you bring them in, you make them feel like it's important.
I regret saying that he's not a great leader in the first two episodes. Like, I think he wasn't. Like, I think he's not ready to be a leader of the whole thing. But I think he does small group leadership really well.
He absolutely does. Yeah. He absolutely, you know, steps up well when he's required to.
Right.
Young says we're none of us the right people, you know, in the right place, but I think Scott really is.
Yeah.
And
that's why I always, that's why I said, like, I kind of wonder what Rush and Scott would have been like if Colonel Young had died. Because I think there would be initial walking all over Scott, but I think he would get it back pretty quickly. And he wouldn't be so against everything Rush does. I think he would listen a little bit better.
Yeah, it would depend.
Right.
It
would depend if Rush killed Young.
it would depend if Rush really, you know, trampled on anything that Scott was sensitive about.
Right.
Because we see that he's clearly religious. Obviously, Rush isn't, like...
Right.
There could be conflict there. But also,
Rush is definitely religious. It's just about a ship.
Yeah, Rush wants to found a special religion and the ninth chevron be its god.
You know who else does? Brody.
No, he just really wants to believe in Rush.
Okay, anyways, so Chloe goes back in a different body. Mom's reaction is to drink.
Yeah.
Chloe's jacket needs to be ironed major time.
Yeah, this, and I don't know what the deal was, if this is what the lady was wearing before, or...
I think she was wearing that before, I thought, but I remember...
Maybe they filmed these scenes a few weeks apart, and, like, wardrobe wasn't available this day.
Or maybe she's a scientist, and she doesn't wrinkle her outfits.
Yeah,
she doesn't
press
iron
her
outfits, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is another scene where I'm like...
I could have cut it. I don't need it.
Yeah, it could be shorter.
Right.
And, like, we're seeing Chloe's reaction, which is one thing. Imagine being her mother and getting this news from, you know, you've been told 5 minutes ago, it's your daughter in this person's body.
Right. And then that person comforting you when you
that,
find out
yeah,
your
that person screaming at you to stop drinking, that person, like, stroking your back while you cry over
the
death
the crap
of your husband.
Of me.
Yeah. I think the reaction of Young's wife in the next couple of episodes here is much more realistic.
Right. Oh, I can't wait to
also,
talk about those.
For purposes of getting viewers on board with this communication stone thing,
right.
I think, you know, you have to make it very clear who is who and not treat it like it's weird.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the mom anymore?
No, I'm pretty much, I mean, it's tragic, it's rough for her, clearly she's not going to deal well, and she's lost a lot, and I feel for her, but I don't know that she's the plot of the show.
Right. So we're back on the ship with Telford going around. I really like that Brody, like, once he figures out that it's not Young, suddenly just, like, clams up. He has no idea how to deal with Telford and Young's body.
I like that the crew is kind of behind Young already.
Right.
Or Rush. Like, either way, they may not be happy to be here, but they're certainly happier with known quantities than with these random people coming in asking questions.
Right.
I like that Park stands up to Telford and is like, we have power concerns. We have other issues.
In my notes, I called Dr. Park Mini Rush.
Yeah, I like Park a lot.
I do, too. She needs more.
Yeah, she is, like, she's just positive, right? She wants this to work, and she sees the good in things, and that's something this ship needs pretty badly.
Yeah, they really should have made her a main character, honestly. I think Chloe's important, but I think Chloe could be relegated to more of a side character, like a Garrick.
Like, yeah.
Is important from episode to episode, but not all the way through. And I would have loved to have Lisa Park. Is it Lisa Park?
It is Lisa Park.
I just made that up. I feel like I would have rather had Park as one of the main characters. Like, because she's one of the people that's in the science team, but is somehow a little bit outside of it. So she could give a different viewpoint of what's really going on in it.
Yeah, and I think the, you know, probably the decision being made in the show was, we need characters to get, you know, it was on sci-fi, so I don't know why you'd need non-science fiction viewers involved, but,
right.
You know, we need to make it accessible, and Chloe is more
They chose accessible. A Harvard graduate to be our accessible character.
But a Harvard graduate in poli-sci, that doesn't necessarily mean she's going to understand astrophysics or whatever.
It was like, who lives in a mansion?
Yeah, whereas Park
she's
had
totally
been on this.
She's totally identifiable, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Park had been on this team for a while. She has, you know, various skills that are useful to them. So
yeah, I identify with Park more, though, just because I believe it's in the next episode when they're doing the documentary stuff. Like, just the way she's taking it with the grace, but at the same time, the fear she does. Yeah. That's so much more accessible to me. So, but, I mean, we can't change what we can't change, so. And I want Elise Levensk to have a job, so.
Yeah, and Chloe is good, and.
Right. So, next, TJ is annoyed with Telford for stressing out Young's body. Telford doesn't care about Park, wants to dial other planets.
Yeah, so Telford is definitely pushing. He clearly came here with a priority, right?
Right.
And as far as we know, no one's being sent the other direction on the communication stones.
Right.
No one, they don't seem to really care who goes.
Right.
Right? So clearly you're just supposed to go and chill and let the people from the situation do their reports on Earth.
Right.
But Telford is the first one we've seen definitely, like, demanding attention and answers and whatever else.
What I'd like to know, though, is because, I mean, there's no way Young doesn't have a concussion, as we discussed. Would that concussion affect Telford's thinking? Because it's technically Young's body.
You ask great questions. I don't know how the actual physicality of the brain relates to the consciousness being transferred into it.
Right. I don't know either.
Yeah, it's, I mean, if that's the case, there's a trans-species swap that happens later. Like, they still seem to be roughly themselves.
Right.
They speak their own languages. They can use the body that they're in to breathe,
right.
Kind of thing. So.
Hmm.
So yeah, maybe Telford is more clear-headed than Young is in Young's body.
I don't know. I'm curious about it. But they don't, I mean, obviously in the show he doesn't have a concussion because he is way more clear-minded and able to walk around and talk and stuff than he should be if he did have a concussion. Like, as I said, I had a minor one a couple times and I was like, I couldn't even walk without feeling nauseated for days.
Yeah, well, maybe, well, he is a colonel in the Air Force, so he might be nauseous and not giving a shit.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying, sorry, nauseation.
But yeah, no, I mean.
But I still couldn't piece words together no matter how hard I tried.
Well, he definitely, it's either more minor or he got really lucky in his landing and didn't thwump himself too badly.
Then I guess that's the case.
Clearly, he is in more pain than he's been letting on, because Telford
like, just
looks like
eats it.
He is in misery. Just
God
like,
damn. Lou
and
Diamond
obviously,
Phillips.
Yeah, obviously he would rather be putting on a strong face and
right.
looking strong in front of these people, but he's doing a shit job of it.
Well, I think it's because, I mean, he hasn't had time to acclimate to how painful the body is, because there's a lot of things that are as painful 10 minutes later as they were from the beginning, but you sort of acclimate yourself to it and adapt to it, and it just doesn't
yeah.
hurt as much.
For sure. He definitely went from, you know, meditating in a chair perfectly comfortable to
right.
excruciating pain.
Right. Oh, speaking of which, remember how we said, like, a lot of the people didn't really go anywhere after Stargate? Lou Diamond Phillips obviously did. He's in Longmire.
Yeah. No, he's wonderful. He's yeah. been all over the place. And
then Elise Levensk was in the originals.
So oh, that's good.
Some of them are going places. I just want David Blue to go places.
Well, he has dropped some weight and he is very attractive. I'm sure his time is coming.
At the risk of sounding creepy, he has always been attractive to me, but...
Oh, well, all right. I mean...
I guess it sounds creepier when you say, at the risk of sounding creepy.
No, Eli was always great. I'm just... I
he's
saw a more
adorable.
Recent headshot of David Blue, and he still looks great.
No, yeah, he's like...
Like...
Oh my god, he's cut. I'm like, what happened to Eli? Anyways. So let's go back to the planet.
Yeah, so back on the planet, the Rush Greer Scott situation is working out as well as could be expected.
It's escalating.
Yeah. They're all under a lot of stress.
Greer threatens to kill Rush by leaving him, and I'm like, oh, is that a foreshadow?
Yeah, because that's, you know, what a horrible thing. Who would ever do that to a person?
Oh, I don't know. Carl Jung?
I
mean, to be fair, Colonel Jung was pretty pissed at the time.
And, yeah, and Scott starts hallucinating.
Yeah.
He thinks is hallucinating. And we get to see that it's actually not a hallucination. It is something real that is affecting
right.
the environment around them.
And then Greer kicks Rush. And, as I said, I assume this is why he was in a jail cell. That's pretty unprofessional, dude.
Yeah, that's pretty unprofessional. But let's talk about what's really happening back on Destiny, because
TJ
knocks Telford the fuck out.
Yeah.
Which is great.
I love it. And she, you know, she always seems so nervous and unsure of herself, but when she needs to make a decision, she definitely commits.
Yeah, I mean,
and
this
pulls
is one
her
of those
rank.
Things. Yeah, exactly. This is where we're like, okay, yeah, she is a lieutenant. She is absolutely in charge.
Right.
And actually, technically with Young out,
mm-hmm.
because his consciousness isn't there, and Scott out, she is ranking officer on Destiny right now.
God, this reminds me of DS9, when they all go on the Defiant, and I'm like, who the hell is controlling the station? Is it Quark?
No, it's like the third ensign from the right. the one that sits right outside Sisko's office, it's his job.
Okay. So yeah, good job for TJ.
So that's possibly my favorite scene in all of Stargate ever. No, I'm sure I'll find a new one, but it's
right.
one of my favorites in this episode. I just,
one of
I
the...
like TJ being competent. I like her being able to pull rank and doing what's right for, you know, her commanding officer's body and also for
right.
the team, because it's clear that Telford is pushing buttons and messing with stuff that they're not supposed to be messing with.
Yeah, she totally intuits that
yeah.
there's something off.
Yeah.
And, I didn't like TJ at first, especially with this scene, because I thought she was doing it because of romantic reasons, and I was wrong. I am big enough to admit that.
Yeah, I mean, you could absolutely read that as, like...
I don't think
maybe,
it is.
Maybe some of the concern came there. Maybe if it was, you know, Eli's body, she'd be slightly less worried.
Right. I don't think she would be.
But, yeah, I think anybody with injuries that severe...
She would have done the same, no matter what.
Yeah, and she's been trying to tell Young to take it easy. Now,
right.
with Telford in his body, you can see how much pain he's in.
Right.
Like, of course she's going to react as a doctor and say, cut it out.
So. Clever lady.
Yep.
So meanwhile, Franklin is like, hey, turns out I'm not as bad at science as everyone says I am. I can dial other planets now. And Eli, on Rush's side suddenly, he goes from accusing Rush to taking them to the ship because he's a megalomaniac who wants all the power in the universe to maybe Rush is right about going to this planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think Eli more than anybody has... He understands that he's in a sci-fi show.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Well, no, so, because he also understands he's in a horror in the same time. Because he's like, no, splitting up, bad idea.
Yeah. Because, you know, when the giant ship that you're depending upon for your life tells you don't go to places B, C, and D.
Right.
You don't go.
Right.
Because if you do, it's gonna be bad.
Yeah. No, I agree. But I do think Franklin makes some good points.
Oh, Franklin absolutely makes good points. And, you know, what they should have done is sent him back to do the override from Destiny. Right. Where they had more Kinos, where they had, you know...
Right.
Equipment to investigate those planets.
Right. Yeah, because that Kino's gone once it goes through.
I believe so.
Yeah,
I
think because he can't remotely dial the gate on the other... Like, because you have to dial the gate from where you're entering. Yeah. So once that Kino goes through, it can't go back through.
Yeah, unless somebody else follows it and brings it back.
Right.
Yeah.
I wonder what happened. Sorry, we'll talk about that later. Scott leaves Greer with Rush then, because Rush is at least man enough to say, like, I can't
go anymore. Yeah, I can't keep pushing.
Yeah.
And
Rush gives him his water, so it's not like he's being a wuss. Like, he knows he has to do the whole walk back now without water. Though no, he did he assume Greer was going to share.
Yeah, he assumes that him and Greer are going to share, and Greer's like, nope.
Poor Raj, he's so logical, and everyone thinks there's some, like, emotional, vindictive component to what he does.
Yeah. Well, because when you have a moderate to high amount of emotions, someone being completely logical feels vindictive.
It's true. It's true. I agree.
Yeah, so... So meanwhile, Scott alone in the desert, which is a great idea.
It's a horrible idea.
We're gonna just skip Chloe's mom screaming at whoever the Air Force dude is.
That's like, such a stupid scene. Like, what are you gonna, what, they don't even follow up on that. Like, does the mom?
Well, no, I think what it is literally, look how worse Chloe could be. People that don't like Chloe because she's, you know, too rich and too political.
Right.
It could be so much worse and more petty.
She could be a drunk woman. Yeah. Dude, but her mom is friends with President Obama.
It would... Would it have been Obama at the time? Yes, it would have. It was 09. Yeah. So. Awesome.
All my note says is, dude, mom, you're going to get shanked. Oh, wait, it's Stargate. Security leak? What do you mean?
Right. Oh, well. So back on the planet, now that Scott's alone, he decides to experiment about his delusions.
Why and it give turns it water? Out, why? What was the leap in logic that made him think, I'll put water on that?
I mean, what's the worst that could happen, right? You dump water out on the ground and nothing happens.
And die of dehydration.
Well, he didn't dump out that much.
That's true.
And if you are on a desert planet and you think something might be alive...
Right.
Odds are it likes water.
Yeah, but then it's gonna eat him.
Yeah, well, you're not wrong.
Alright. So, then he sees the face of the priest.
Yeah. It's unclear from here on out what that Scott's seeing is real.
Right.
And what that Scott's seeing is... really not.
I don't think any of it's real. It's all a hallucination.
Well, the little dust devil of sand is real.
Okay, well, that's real for sure. But the people that he sees, those are definitely hallucinations.
Yeah, absolutely. Rush gets in Greer's face about having too big of a chip on his shoulder, but
with his own fucking big chip on his shoulder.
Yeah, he doesn't do it in the most thoughtful, companionable way.
He kind of does it in a racist way, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, calling someone poor and having to go to military because if they didn't, they were going to be criminals, that's one of the biggest allegations that we put against young black men in the military. It's unfucking deniable. And then there's Rush just doing it, and then he's like, and I had it so e- I mean, I had it worse because my dad had a job at the shipyards. And you're like, okay.
Yeah, I had it worse because I only had my brain to rely on, and I got a scholarship to Oxford.
Right? And you're just like, shut up, Rush.
Yeah, he... I think there was definitely an opportunity there.
To, like, come to terms with each other, and yeah, Rush just fucking burned it.
Yup. Rush threw a grenade at that son of a bitch, and
I think I think it's because Greer kicked him.
Yeah.
I think that was the last straw for Rush, was, like, you put a gun at me, and now you kicked me. And now you won't share your fucking water. They're, like, six-year-olds, and...
Yeah, I mean, I think my note was, Rush and Greer get into an actual scrap.
I wrote, they fight like six-year-olds.
Yeah, they go rolling down a hill.
But can we talk about how awesome Jameel Smith-Walker is? As he just... his delivery of his lines are so good.
Yeah, he's... He really inhabits Greer. And Greer is a really real character to me. Like,
he's the realest character I've ever seen on Stargate, ever.
He has a history.
Right.
He reacts to things based on that history. He grows and changes as things go on and happen to him.
He's the most military the most military member of Stargate that Stargate has ever had.
Yeah, which is probably why he was locked in a broom cupboard on Icarus.
Right? Because he's the only actual military person.
Yeah, sorry, Sergeant, you're being too much in the military right now, and we need you to actually just dick around a little.
We're like, in the Stargate program, we dick around a lot.
Yeah.
You should get used to that.
So, despite their squabble and tussle, Rush and Greer make it back in time to stop one of the scientists from going through the gate.
So, supposedly in the original script, Greer just shoots him, and they decided on the day or in rehearsal, I can't remember, that they wanted Rush to tell Greer to shoot him. Which just complicates and muddies the water of what that relationship is even more, in my opinion. Like, it's so complex.
It is. Because I think, in a lot of ways, Greer and Rush they're similar and they would make similar decisions.
Right. I mean, it's been proven already, because they both let Armstrong just go.
There's a moment in Leverage where Elliot talks to Parker about, like, the kinds of decisions that the two of them can make that the other three people on the team can't,
mm-hmm.
because of who they are and because of their histories and being less human, less emotionally tied to morals.
Right.
Which doesn't make them bad people. It means there's certain situations they can survive and they can make the right decisions where other people wouldn't. And I feel like that's Rush and Greer here.
Right.
Obviously, Greer wouldn't have done it if he didn't already want to.
Right. I felt that Greer was using it as an excuse. Like, he can do it and definitely not get in trouble because Rush told him to.
Yeah,
because that gun was already up. He just really needed one more confirmation for, like, in his brain, he knew it was the right thing to do. And having Rush saying do it was all he needed. That was just all he needed.
And Scott had already said stop them if you can.
Right.
So, the downside is that Rush told him to, Rush gets back through that gate with Franklin, just goes, Greer shot him.
I mean, he's not wrong.
He's not wrong, but it's just such a Rush, like, allow me to tell you the part of the truth I want you to know.
I know, when he did that, I was like, you little shit.
Yep, you know.
Okay, where are we? We lose Palmer and we lose Curtis. They're gone.
Yep, I don't believe we ever see them again.
Nope, we never do, which sucks.
Yeah, Greer goes tromping out into the desert to go find Scott, which seems like, that seems like an even worse idea.
Right.
Like, okay, so you're now going to backtrack the hours you just walked to the point where you split to then track him.
Right. But that shows that is a very military thing to do, I think.
Yeah,
just
for
from
sure.
What I was, I mean, I've been listening to Serial with the Bo Bergdahl case, and the military takes very seriously Leave No Man Behind.
Yeah.
So to Greer, this is a natural decision. Though I do love when he has to, like, walk back to show Eli how to use the gun.
Yeah, Eli's like, what? Which, it's further refining exactly what kind of nerd Eli is.
Right.
Because there are nerdy people like Eli who would know exactly what kind of gun that is and how to use it. And
Yeah. Well, okay. I want to talk about the Rush thing real quick, because RAS stuff. So, like, and Greer's about to leave, Rush is, like, super dismissive, and he's like, well, wasn't a pleasure knowing you, fuck off, you're gonna die.
Yeah.
And at first I read that as, like, man, Rush can be such an asshole, but I when I reread this, I think this was him trying to reach Greer at his level. And,
yeah.
And convince him of the other decision. Like, I really think this was him, like, this is his best effort to piss Greer off enough.
That he would stay.
That he would stay, yeah.
Yeah, because in all honesty, like, if you're coming from the Rush point of view, you completely believe that Greer is about to die.
Right.
Greer is someone who just made a decision that you agree with, so you're slightly, you know, in approval of him.
Right.
And, you know, Rush probably would have, not gladly, but if Greer had wanted to waste 10 or 15 minutes, you know, standing there beating the shit out of him, Rush would have taken that as a victory.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, that could just be us being Rush apologists, but just the way he does it, to me, suggests that this was his only choice or only chance to get Greer not to do that, which thankfully he didn't. He was wrong to try and stop him in a way.
Yeah, but it's, again, it's that completely, you know, Greer is doing, in this case, kind of an emotional thing. The no man left behind, gotta go find my buddy thing.
Right.
When really the logical thing is what feels emotionally wrong, which is just stay here.
Right, right.
You know, call Scott a loss. It's a huge planet. It's over.
Right.
But you're right. Rush turned out to be wrong, and he'll never admit it. So, the end.
There you go. Well, I mean, he could also have been doing it to try to make himself not have a guilty conscience later on.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows? Weirdly... Eli is optimistic about the gun when everything is shit. He's like, I have a gun.
I mean, Eli's excited about anything new.
We're all gonna die, but I have a gun.
Well, they're at the gate, so he's not gonna die.
Yeah, he is, because if they don't get the limestone back in time, they're gonna die.
Yeah, I guess there's that.
So Young comes back in the next scene. And I summarized his feelings as fuck Telford.
Yeah.
Because he's in so much more pain than he was before.
Yeah, he's like, oh god, what just happened?
Right. Then Rush goes through the gate, blames Greer for the shooting. You little shit.
Yep.
Poor Riley. My favorite scene in all of these three episodes is Riley just going, well, there goes my water.
Yeah, if that was my ration. Oops.
Well, part of me's like, shut up, Riley. You were on a ship all day, and he was in the desert.
Well, also, I'm pretty sure, I don't know a lot about rationing, but I'm pretty sure when you've sent people out to a desert planet, you're going to expect to use up some extra water rations on them.
I don't know. Maybe they're so disorganized that they haven't quite thought of some of those things yet.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to Scott. Turns out he's religious, which, as I said, is funny because I feel like Rush is the most religious character on the ship, honestly.
Rush has the most faith, but Scott is the most religious.
Right.
Because Rush's faith is not in some organized thing or a god or
it's
whatever.
It's something that's logical to him.
Yeah. Right. Whereas Scott clearly doesn't... I don't know if he feels his faith as deeply and internally as some people I have known, given that he has knocked up one girl and then was still banging James.
Right.
Well,
I mean, I think to him it's a... I think his faith is just a matter of how he was raised, right?
So, well, yeah, and it's absolutely something that you know, that affects him and affects his decision making and is a part of his character that makes his character deeper.
So one of the things I find really interesting about, say, therapists who specialize in sex is that they will often encounter people who really don't believe in God anymore, but because they were raised, say, in a Catholic church, they still have all those hang-ups.
Oh, absolutely.
Even though they think that their religion is a piece of shit. I'm not saying that it is or not. I'm just saying that there are people like that who think it's a piece of shit. They don't believe in God whatsoever. They think organized religion is a sham. And yet they still feel all that Catholic guilt they were raised in. And I'm feeling that is what Scott is.
That definitely could be a part of it. I can see that.
But I mean, when they're in the church scene, right? Which we're only skipping over Curtis and Palmer not answering the radio.
Yeah.
The girl is 16. Scott does not look 16 in that scene.
Oh, see, and I was just gonna say, like, they did an actual good job of making him look a little younger.
He still looked like he was 20 to me, so I was like,
Oh, I mean,
oh.
I could see him being 17 or 18.
The commentary said that he was supposed to be 16 in that scene, so I'll believe it. But I like when I first
Okay.
watched that scene before the commentary, I was like, "Oh,
He's, I mean,
Scott."
they made his hair a little fuzzier. They made him have kind of like spotty, like teenage skin.
That's true. That's true. His clothing was sort of teenager-like.
He's very like he's hunched in on himself. His shoulders look narrower. Like,
Right.
I can see they tried. Obviously, they only had the same actor, and
Right. Oh, don't make me seem like the bitch.
Nope, he was 25
And she
and
was
just,
16 and it was
yeah.
sick.
Whatever.
But he says in that scene, he goes, "He was calling," and I can't figure out if he's talking about Jesus or the baby that he thinks is dead. And
I
then he
have
looks at the
no.
priest and he says, "It's not your fault." And I can't figure out like what could have been the priest's fault. I'm trying to figure out who's calling to him or if it's just a part of the hallucination that maybe it's not a true memory, kind of like how when Jung was dreaming, that wasn't a true memory because he seized in the dream and in reality.
Yeah, that may be an extended bit of conversation.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Because I don't have that, I don't think. I don't have
Okay.
notes about it, at least.
Okay.
But
Well, Scott,
maybe.
somehow that conversation in the church gets him more willpower and he manages to get up and test. It's somewhat suggested that the sandstorm is what helped him in a way.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's like water bubbling up from the ground suddenly to
Yeah.
wake him up, and then, so this is a weird sort of planet,
Right. Well, no,
where.
it's those parasites are they somehow know that they have a free ride to food somehow.
Yeah, maybe so.
All right.
If they fall, so Scott does the test, finds the limestone,
Now
and is
exhausted,
apparently,
has to carry a shit ton of stone back with him.
yeah, is out of radio range,
Right.
apparently.
Yeah. Well, no, I believe
But
that.
yeah, I mean, what worried me, like, it's all well and good to be like, okay, I tested this ground, you know, it's gonna work. What he tested was this sort of calcified layer,
Right.
and then he just starts scooping sand indiscriminately.
Well,
And I'm
see,
like,
that's why he needed a scientist with
this is
him.
why you brought scientists to the planet, Matthew, but
No, yeah, there's. God damn it. I'm sure Palmer could have went as far. Geologists, because they have to go out in the field like every year, they're a hardy bunch. They probably would have survived longer than the military people. Unless the
Yeah.
military people are used to going out to the deserts, which I know a lot are because of Iraq and whatnot. But I don't think Scott served in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, well, Scott said literally that this was
His
going to be his
first,
first
yeah.
assignment,
Right.
out of officer training. So,
Now they're putting first assignments out of officer training into the Stargate program. Come on! Come on,
well,
Stargate!
you know, if specifically being assigned to Icarus in the military basically meant you were going to Destiny, right? Like
Right.
to where they didn't know where.
Right.
And Scott doesn't have, well,
Oh, you're
doesn't
right. He
have
doesn't have
kids,
family.
doesn't have family.
You're right.
So actually, you know, in a volunteer kind of setting, he's probably the one that would say, hell yeah, I got nothing.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. You're right. So anyways.
Yeah, so probably, no, not most people straight out of officer training, but ones that are like, I will take any assignment and I don't care if I come back, without sounding suicidal, because obviously that would be a psychological assessment issue.
Right.
So anyway, back on Destiny, we've got TJ cleaning up the aftermath of this kind of shitty situation.
Chloe kind of working as a nurse. And Franklin, yeah. Oh my god. I'm just like, I feel like every episode I'm just going to be like, oh, Franklin. Because he's in so much pain. That guy just looks absolutely dejected and demoralized.
Yeah.
Like,
and
he doesn't
and
even
TJ
recognize.
And TJ just used her daily Lasses. Usage of... heavy yeah. sedatives to knock out Telford's ass, so.
Right? So she's probably pissed as hell about that, because this guy really could have used it.
Yeah, exactly.
we get shots of the dejected crew. Scott can't make it any further. Greer yells at him.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah, Young did send through a fresh team to go try and track Scott and Greer, and they... You know, they couldn't find him.
Right.
I like that when they get back, Young is like, it's okay, you did what you could. Like,
right.
He's always positive. He's always trying to be there and keep morale up.
Right.
Which is so important in the situation they're in.
No, I agree with you. I was like, as I said, usually my problems with Young lie in his personal life.
Yeah,
mostly.
Rather than
90%.
His
leadership. Yeah, 90% of the time I'm just like, ah, you hypocritical jerk. So then they realize that the Stargate's going to close before Greer and Scott get there.
Yeah, but Eli has told them, like, he can see Scott and Greer. They
right.
have, like, triple timed it back.
Right.
Which, can we talk about the stamina on Ronald Greer here for a second.
Amazing.
Like, he's
done the distance twice.
Yeah. He went all the way out there with Rush. He dragged Rush all the way back, literally kicking and screaming.
Right.
And then got all the way back out further than that.
Right.
And then back again.
Well, because we met Greer as perfect military man. He's what a Marine is.
Yeah. Only he, for some reason, is... an NCO sergeant, which sucks.
Well, I'm gonna bet it's because, well, yeah, you just said
yeah,
NCO.
Yeah, because of his attitude, yeah.
Well, no, non-commissioned officer is usually a function of the poverty you grew up in.
Oh, well, there you go.
So, that
or
means...
Or your education level, or...
Right, well, that's what I'm saying, it's a function of poverty, right? So, that's why a lot of people don't like commissioned officers, because they tend to come from families that can afford college. And yes, there's ROTC, I do understand that, but there's still a level of education you need to have from a good community that
yeah.
can get you
a good
through
community
ROTC
or contacts. Or,
exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
And they also don't like them because they don't have as much experience in the field as the NCOs do. And those are the people that get them killed. But, yeah, it makes sense to me that Greer would be NCO.
So we have what we talked about earlier, in that rather than fighting with Young over the decision that he's already made,
right.
Rush just says, give me the radio, and then tells Eli to do something ridiculous.
Right.
Which is put a part of himself through the event horizon and don't walk through, just
right.
hold it.
God, but, I mean, as I said, like, he looks tortured right there. Like, he doesn't...
Yeah.
I think he's figured out everyone's gonna die anyways, no matter what. And so might as well try this.
I guess that's true.
But he doesn't
want
Eli to be in pain, so I think that's why he looks so tortured.
Yeah, it's his absolute last option, and he's not 100% sure that it's the best one.
Oh, he's crapping his pants.
Yeah.
At least that was my interpretation of that scene.
And he does, you know, that very, like, hand on arm, like, well done, Eli.
Right.
Which is...
I love that Eli's, like, patting his arm when he comes through. Did you see that? Like, when he falls through after Greer and Scott, the first thing he does is he like, grabs for his arm and is like, oh my god, it's there.
Oh, I like that. Because it probably, I mean, from what we've seen of what it looks like inside a Stargate, it must have felt like it was just being stretched out like Mr. Fantastic or something.
Oh, I wonder how it felt. That's a good question.
Yeah, no, Eli does come straight through and go, oh my god, my arm, okay, okay, I'm fine.
Eli does so many great things with the gate, because we forgot to mention that the first time he goes through it, he, like, takes, like, a gulp of air like he's going into water. Because it looks like water, right?
Yeah, it does. And they call it the puddle, so...
Yeah. And then the second time you see him, he does it again, but a little bit less, less dramatically. Like, because he knows this time, but he's still like, well, just in case.
Yeah.
I love David Blue's acting choices, and I love Eli. I think that's great.
Eli's really awesome.
Right.
I think he's the character we needed, and I'm glad they gave us Chloe as well.
Right.
But oh, well. Then we get our first musical interlude ending.
Yeah.
Which is something that I absolutely adore about the series as a whole.
You know, what's funny to me about these musical interludes is now I love them, but I came from a very classic sci-fi background originally, where it doesn't matter how contemporary it is.
And this made it feel like Grey's Anatomy to you?
Yeah. Well, because I believe the song was used on Grey's Anatomy. At least, a song by this singer was used.
Yeah, and there was a song called Breathe that was used, but I don't think it was this song.
No, this song is Breathe.
Well, I know. Oh. But in Grey's Anatomy, there's a different... Anyway.
I believe that this song might have been used on Grey's Anatomy.
I would absolutely believe it. I think it is much more appropriate here.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, when you watch Enterprise and you're like, Faith of the Heart, fuck you. We need, like epic orchestral swells and stuff. But, like, this was so much more touching. Like, the lyrics were so beautifully perfect for the scene, as everyone's just like starting to breathe in the oxygen and realizing like, oh my god, this, we had so little left.
I mean, it's in a lot of ways, you and I both live at very high altitude,
right?
And I think we've all had this moment if we've, you know, flown down to California or something.
It's almost too much sometimes.
Suddenly, you know, you're a pretty sedentary person and you're like, oh yeah, I'll go play tag with the 6-year-olds outside. Like, that's fine. Just the energy you get from having that oxygen.
It only lasts like a week or two, unfortunately, because I used to run. Well, I still run. But I do, like, about 45 to an hour of running. And I went to New York, which is about sea level. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm, like, on 2 hours. Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
But, yeah. So I definitely can identify with that feeling.
I remember making notes about very... there's a specific line in this song.
Yeah.
About, like, there being... Like, this is your whole life. There's no 11th hour reprieve.
Right.
Which is simultaneously perfect and kind of contradicted by the situation. Like, they did. Right. They just saved themselves the last minute. But they're still not anywhere good.
No.
This isn't like Rodney McKay ran in with a ZPM and went, oh, we can dial Earth now. It's fine.
Right. No, they're still going to have food and water to worry about very soon.
Yeah.
And the powers, and they've already been talking about it, which happens in darkness. There's not enough power for the ship with the life support going on and everything like that.
And then...
I just like the lyric when it said, don't forget to breathe. I felt that was so powerful. Like, we forget how important breathing is in science fiction. We just forget it all the time.
Yeah, and you forget that even in your life sometimes until you've got a really bad...
Right.
You know, infection in your lungs or, you know, for some other reason, you are limited on oxygen.
Is that a true story, Cetra?
True story.
I have to edit out so much of your, like, breathing sometimes.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. It's what's happening to you. It's what it is.
Yeah, the panic that you go through when suddenly, like, oh, I've been coughing for 30 seconds and I...
need oxygen.
Get oxygen into me, that's a problem.
Yeah.
But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about Matt being the only person who says the right thing to Chloe.
I thought O'Neill did a good job, but you're right, Scott.
O'Neill did the right thing for a military commander who was a friend of her father.
Right.
What Scott tells her is, some things you don't get over.
Right.
And that's okay.
Good job, Scott.
And really, like, that's what she needed to be told. Was not, you know, chin up, soldier on. You know, it was worth it. He right. saved us all.
Right.
Or even, you know, to some extent, like, I remember him, he was a good man, which is more helpful than what Young and Rush did.
Right.
What Scott says is, this will change you, and that's okay.
Yeah, no, Scott nailed it. Good job for Scott.
It's okay for you to have feelings about this, and you won't be the same, and there's nothing that you can do about it except soldier on.
Don't forget to breathe.
Yep, exactly.
You know how touching that scene was, but at the same time, I was like, Chloe, why are you grabbing that hand? It is sunburned as fucking shit.
Yeah.
That had to hurt.
I will say, I really like that they got sunburned.
No, I love that, but Chloe, don't grab that hand.
Yeah, and that the people who were on, oh, right here, end of the episode, they jettisoned the senator's body.
See, I couldn't figure out if that was a ship that was, like, a Nakai ship that just happened to be on.
No, it's shaped like one of Destiny shuttles.
Okay, I guess I don't know what a Destiny shuttle looks like.
I think. That sounds like an awesome thing for people to yell at us about in comments.
Right. Like, it was clearly a Nakai ship on top of the Destiny.
Clearly they were introducing early aliens. Because there's no explanation of what that ship is or what it's doing.
Right. I don't know. The cynical person in me wants it to be aliens, so, like, it doesn't feel so out of left field so much later on. though it doesn't, I mean, and you start rewatching this stuff, it's not that out of left field because, you know, they go, oh, this ship looks like it's been through a battle or several.
Yeah.
But you forget that because it's one comment in the first episode, and then it's just planets with nobody on it except their own skulls.
Yeah, well, that and, oh, I guess the Nakai stuff all happens before the planet with the obelisk.
Well, no, the obelisk happens while they know what the Nakai is, but you don't know what the obelisks. So, as I recall,
I don't think we ever know what the obelisks do. I think it's non-canon, everything that I think about it.
So. True. So, what are your final thoughts for this episode? Because we are way running over time.
We are way over time. I love the music in this show.
I agree.
I love the way that it gets used, and I know that it was kind of a product of its time. A lot of shows were featuring, you know, pop music or artists like that, but this show does it so thoughtfully, I think.
Right.
Well,
it just reminds you that these people are our contemporaries. Like, as I said, like, originally I was like, oh, you don't do this in a sci-fi. But then I'm like, no, these are people, supposedly, obviously I know they're not real, that are living at the same time I am, and they're stuck out there. Of course, this is the kind of music they are also listening to.
And they managed to use it in a way that feels a little like the early episodes of Lost, where Hugo still had his,
his
Walkman.
iPod. Oh, God, and that would hurt.
That would be how they would introduce music. And I listen to music so constantly that when I think about a situation like this, like, I know that I would go kind of nuts.
I have to say the saddest scene in Lost is when Hurley's iPod dies.
It's not even an iPod. It's a Discman.
Oh, you're right. It's a Discman. When that dies, you're just like, oh, yeah. I'm so sorry, baby.
Because we've all had that moment, right, where you dropped your CD player or something and it just stops.
Yeah.
And, no, like, it's like the whole world skipped. It's crazy.
I went into a depression when my iPod, like, had fallen out of my pocket on a hike because I had, like, put my phone, like, I used my phone because this is when iPods and phones were different things. I mean, they still are to some extent, but for the most part people use their phones for everything now. But it, like, fell out of my pocket and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I was, like, just depressed because I needed it, like, going shopping was so much more bearable listening to music, and going on runs was so much more bearable listening to music, and feeding the horses was so much more bearable listening to music. But what sucks, though, is that the music in Stargate is all in the background, so I don't even know if they get any music. Like, I know in fan fiction, they talk about, like, you know, sometimes the computers they had some stuff on the hard drives and they, like, trade.
But yeah, and I know...
That's not confirmed in canon.
Yeah, we saw Rush listening to classical music.
In his base on Icarus, and that certainly didn't
Yeah,
come
on
with
Icarus,
him.
And we hear Volker talking about it later, but we don't know what he has. I thought that at least... then again, you haven't seen season 2.
Right.
I believe in season 2 we do actually see them having some kind of devices and things like that.
Okay. Well, I'll just have to watch season 2 finally. I just don't want it to end. The second I start season 2 means it's going to start ending.
Yeah, but it is a vast and wide multiverse and there are other alternatives. I'm really excited for the next episode because I have a lot of feelings about the next 2-episode arc. I like that this show opens with solving very real problems about being in space.
I agree.
Yeah. So we have air now, but next problem is power. So
yep.
There we go.
So if you want to contact us, how do they contact us, Ms. Cetra?
Oh, we are at sgupodcast.tumblr.com.
And we'll be glad to talk to you.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, bye.
Absolutely. Okay, bye.